This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 1st, 2002. I'm Carlos Favara, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez. Negotiations continue in Congress for a resolution to use force in Iraq. Convicted killer James Rexford Powell will be the last death row inmate executed in Texas before the upcoming November elections. The Bush administration recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Mass dissent in military ranks has led to bloody revolt in the Ivory Coast. Rebel soldiers have taken control of more land and are threatening to topple the government. In the predominantly Muslim north, there were reports that civilians rallied behind the soldiers. They're calling the rebellion the Patriotic Movement of Ivory Coast and demanding the release of soldiers now in prison or in exile. French troops, the former colonial power, have moved in to help stabilize the country. Senior ministers from Nigeria, Ghana, and Togo are traveling to the Ivory Coast, hoping to negotiate a peaceful resolution. A series of one-day strikes are rolling through London. Anastasia Kershaw has the story.
London will be almost crippled tomorrow as workers stage a 24-hour strike over conditions and pay. Action begins this evening and is the latest in a series of strikes that have hit business sectors across the capital as workers battle to afford the spiralling cost of living in London. Today, council workers also walked out in parts of the city. Also from tonight, members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport unions take industrial action. Next week, it's the turn of education staff. This is Anastasia Kershaw reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Activists claim Washington, D.C. police used intimidation during the weekend of protests during the World Bank meetings. More than 650 people were arrested as they marched against what they consider to be an undemocratic organization making decisions for the world's poor without their participation. D.C. Police Chief Charles Ramsey said protesters threatened the city for months and gave his police force an A-plus for their performance.
And we're out here today and this weekend providing support to demonstrators.
So we expect... I've got to ask you to back up to keep the sidewalk clear. I respect what you're doing. I honor your commitment to it. But please keep the
sidewalk clear. Actually, the people are able to pass, so we're not having an incommoding problem. See, okay. She
you
can actually walk from there to there. If she can walk from there to there, we're not having an incommoding problem right now.
Mara Verhaden-Hilliard, co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice and with the National Lawyers Guild, says there are witnesses to the intimidation.
We've seen that repeatedly here. We've seen it in Washington, D.C. We've seen it in California. We've seen it in Philadelphia. We've seen it in New York City. We've seen it in cities all over the country where people join together in a growing social justice movement to oppose the war that's coming, to oppose the policies in the IMF and World Bank, to oppose corporate greed. And what we have then is we have law enforcement coming out repeatedly in a paramilitarized fashion. They come out, they trap and detain people, they beat people, they stifle dissent.
The Independent Government Accounting Office charges the Labor Department with poorly enforcing child labor laws in high-risk workplaces. Ellen Ratner reports from D.C.
Although the Labor Department is effectively enforcing child labor laws in relatively safe workplaces such as grocery and retail stores, the investigative arm of Congress has found the government deficient at applying these standards in the most dangerous workplaces. Darlene Adkins of the Child Labor Coalition says the report sheds light on the dangers many child workers face.
500 kids are injured every day, and one child is killed on the job every 5 days. So it is a very timely issue, and it's a very dangerous situation.
Although only 10% of the estimated 3.7 million employed teenagers currently labor in factories or farms, Labor Department officials say that so few teenagers actually work in these high-risk industries that it would be a waste of money to scrutinize them more closely. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ellen Ratner.
Finally, California Governor Gray Davis has approved legislation giving the state's farm workers new powers to negotiate labor contracts. Chris Bruni has more.
Members of the United Farm Workers Union and their supporters cheered when the governor's spokesperson announced the signing of two bills which offer mediation to farm workers involved in labor disputes. The measures didn't give the farm workers everything they sought, however. The UFW wanted a stringent mediation process to break tough labor disputes with growers. But Davis signed two weaker measures. The issue had placed Davis in a bind between two of his constituencies, the mostly Latino farm workers, and the agriculture industry, which has made significant contributions to his reelection effort against Republican Bill Simon. Agriculture groups say they will likely sue to get the new law overturned. For Free Speech Radio News in San Francisco, I'm Chris Bruni.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Iraq and the United Nations agreed today in Vienna that inspectors would be given unfettered access to a range of sites, including the headquarters of Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard. But Iraq stopped short of agreeing that inspectors would be allowed to inspect Mr. Hussein's presidential palaces, as the United States and Britain have demanded.
Mohammed El-Baradei, head of the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, yesterday praised the attitude of Iraqi officials as positive and businesslike at crucial talks in Vienna with the chiefs of the UN inspection missions. For example, he said, Iraq pledged to supply 4 years of detailed reports on so-called dual-use technology that can be used for military purposes. Yet with the talks now ended, uncertainty looms. Over the weekend, the U.S. and U.K. unveiled a draft Security Council resolution that would rewrite the rules for the inspections. Inspectors would be accompanied by U.S., British, or U.N. armed forces. They would have the right to enter political, national security, or religious buildings, including mosques, without prior notice. Iraq would have 7 days to accept or reject the terms, and any non-compliance could trigger military strikes. Stephen Zunes is Associate Professor of Politics and Chair of the Peace and Justice Studies Program at the University of San Francisco.
If the Bush administration is successful in convincing the United Nations to authorize the use of force against Iraq, particularly after they agreed to the return of UN inspectors with unfettered access to potential sites for Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, it will demonstrate, I think, to most of the world that the United Nations, or at least the Security Council, has essentially become a tool for U.S. foreign policy.
The U.S. had hoped to table the proposal in the Security Council on Monday, but it had been facing resistance from its allies. U.S. and British envoys fanned out to Paris, Moscow, and Beijing this weekend, but so far France, Russia, and China, the other permanent veto-bearing members of the Council, are continuing to reject any proposal for military action before the inspectors have had a chance to do their work. Hossein Alisadeh, coordinator of the Fellowship of Reconciliation's Campaign of Conscience for the Iraqi People, says the Bush and Blair administrations have failed to convince other nations of the threat they say is posed by Saddam Hussein.
If Iraq is a threat, it should be a threat to its neighbors in the first place. None of the neighbors are claiming that Iraq is a threat to them. None of them are asking for help from the United States. If Saddam Hussein cannot threaten, you know, his own neighbors, how come you, who are sitting thousands of miles away from the Middle East, feel threatened by this guy?
British Prime Minister Tony Blair's long-awaited dossier on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction launched last week. It not only failed to convince many skeptics, it actually undermines the Bush administration's case regarding an imminent Iraqi nuclear threat. This, according to David Albright, a former UN weapons inspector, now president of the Institute for Science and International Security.
What was in the British dossier was two statements. And the first was that if sanctions aren't working, and the prior sentence was that they seem to be working, Iraq would need at least 5 years to build a facility to make highly enriched uranium.
Albright is equally dubious about the proposal for armed inspections, even though, ironically, he helped to develop it with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I sure wouldn't want to get caught between armed guards at Iraqi facilities and and military forces under the control of the chief inspector. It's also, I think, very risky to give a chief inspector control over military force because he may choose to start a war.
If all goes according to plan, UN weapons inspectors will be in Baghdad by October 15th. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Pauline Bartolone, reading for Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Negotiations continue in Congress for a resolution to use force on Iraq. Passage of some kind of resolution looks likely, but Democrats and now some prominent Republicans say the U.S. should try harder to build an international coalition before a preemptive strike against Iraq. Josh Chaffin reports from Capitol Hill.
This morning, President Bush suggested the Democrats' draft resolution for using force on Iraq is weaker than one passed in 1998.
I don't want to get a resolution which ties my hands.
Iraq has reportedly agreed again to unfettered access for weapons inspectors. The U.S. says it will work to thwart the inspectors' mission if they don't have more access than in the past. Most Democrats publicly support widening the war on Iraq if Saddam Hussein does not cooperate, but they say the White House is asking for too wide a mandate. They want President Bush to agree not to use force against Iraq's neighbors, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen, and they want to change the U.S. goal in Iraq. Richard Durbin of Illinois.
If you start with the premise of regime change, you've almost disqualified, you have disqualified the United Nations, because under their charter, they are not in the business of regime change.
A handful of Senate Republicans are asking the White House to secure an international coalition against Iraq before it starts a wider war. Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel spoke yesterday, having sat through 2 months of testimony from experts on Iraq.
We must plan for and think through the day-after scenarios, the costs, and the commitments to rebuilding Iraq's political culture and economy. Iraq is rich in human and natural resources. But a democratic transition will require a strong U.S. political, economic, and military presence and engagement for the months and years after Saddam's removal.
Congress's General Accounting Office says a new war on Iraq would likely cost $8 or $9 billion a month after an initial $13 billion invasion cost. President spokesman Ari Fleischer disputes those figures. He says also the money could be saved if the Iraqis would exile or assassinate Saddam Hussein themselves. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
Monday, President Bush signed the U.S. Foreign Relations Authorization Act for 2003, naming Jerusalem the new capital of Israel. Previous administrations put off such a move because of the potential conflict it would cause in the Arab world, which considers East Jerusalem to be occupied territory and the capital of a future Palestinian state. As the Palestinian cabinet met Tuesday amid the ruins of Yasser Arafat's compound in the West Bank city of Ramallah, cabinet members issued a communique calling on the UN Security Council, the Arab League, and the Islamic Conference to intervene. Awad Douabez reports from Ramallah.
The Palestinian Authority considered the decision to name Jerusalem the capital of Israel as a strike against international law, UN resolutions, and the peace process, reminding that all UN-related resolutions consider Jerusalem as an occupied city since 1967 and the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinian population was not surprised by the U.S. congressional mandate. Mace, a local company employee, explains.
We have nothing to do with this decision, because Palestinians will never agree with such a decision. They should stop what they are doing towards us. We have to work hard, because all the world situation is getting against us. And so we have just to work hard so as to change something.
This feeling is shared by Raja Karakra, a political science graduate student. For him, the mandate is unaccepted and will only prompt more anger and bloodshed. The Israeli occupation of Arab East Jerusalem includes one of Islam's holiest shrines, Al-Aqsa Mosque.
That is not acceptable for the Palestinian people, not from the normal people or for the president. Jerusalem is the main case in the Palestinian problem. We cannot make any concession in this case. And America is calling for a negotiation with the Palestinian Authority. About what we negotiate if they take decision like this, I think that will lead for more killing, more problems in the Middle East, all the Middle East. It's the case, not only the case of Palestinian, it's the case of Arab nation and the Muslim nation, all of it. The only thing we can fight for it for that.
Observers say Bush's mandate to name Jerusalem as the new capital of Israel makes it harder for Palestinians to see the United States as a neutral mediator in a potential peace negotiations. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's administration, which has referred to the United City of Jerusalem its eternal capital, had no immediate comment about the U.S. mandate, but many Palestinians, as much of the Arab world, consider the mandate another obstacle impeding any sort of calm in the Middle East conflict. This is Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
Convicted killer James Rexford Powell will be the last man scheduled to be executed in Texas before the upcoming November elections. Concerns about the defense he received from his court-appointed attorneys that led to his death penalty verdict instead of life in prison has caused the International Commission on Human Rights to request the execution be halted while they review possible violations of his rights under international law. But with six major candidates running for Texas Attorney General, Governor, and U.S. Senate in the state, holding pro-death penalty stances, issues of fairness in the application of capital punishment continue to take a back seat to safer issues like being tough on crime. From Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas, Renee Feltz reports.
If James Rexford Powell is executed tonight, he will join a long list of Texas death row prisoners who've gone to their graves complaining their court-appointed attorneys did not adequately represent them in the trials that led to their death sentences. In 1991, a Jefferson County jury sentenced Powell to death for the kidnapping, aggravated sexual assault, and murder of 10-year-old Felicia Van Winkle. During the important penalty phase of his original trial, state prosecutors were allowed to present evidence from another criminal trial in which Powell was acquitted of capital murder because the Louisiana jury found crucial eyewitness testimony to be unreliable. Powell's current attorney, Nick Trent Acosta, is outraged the state was allowed to use the same unreliable eyewitness to demonstrate to a Texas jury that Powell could be a future danger to society if he was released from prison.
I know of no case in the country where a person who had once been found not guilty, where the government has been allowed to ignore that verdict by a jury and try to convince another jury that he was actually guilty, all in the effort to kill him.
Powell lost his 1994 appeal based on this issue and was later represented by another court-appointed attorney during his habeas corpus proceedings. This time, his lawyer refused to file any issues on his behalf, and the judge denied Powell the opportunity to challenge the conduct of his lawyer or defend himself, Trent Acosta.
Then the Texas court said that he could not raise any issues for himself. In essence, he cannot try to save his own life because we gave him a broken-down lawyer.
When the case reached the federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, it was unable to address Powell's argument that the Texas courts had violated his right to a fair and reliable trial guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution.
Had his lawyer signed his name under these issues, we could determine whether the trial was fair or not. But because the prisoner did it, we will refuse to do so.
Powell's problems are not unique in Texas. Poor representation by court-appointed attorneys has led other prisoners on Texas death row to argue they were not properly defended. Despite the state's adamantly pro-death penalty stance, last year, legislators passed the Fair Defense Act, designed to reform the procedures for providing court-appointed defense counsel to indigent defendants. In a related program, Texas Defender Service attorney John Nyland assists lawyers at the trial level by training them in capital defense. He argues Texans don't know enough about how the death penalty is carried out.
But even those that are in favor of it, I doubt that they would be in favor of the way it was imposed if they knew the way in which it is actually implemented and imposed in the state. And I'm hoping that that's where the political debate is going to be.
Polls indicate a slightly lower number of Texans support capital punishment across the board, but the issue is still too much of a hot potato for candidates in the upcoming November elections to handle in depth. Many limit themselves to general support for the death penalty, perhaps even avoiding the issue. Senatorial candidate Attorney General John Cornyn presides over the office that tells district attorneys when to request execution dates from judges. The state executes an average of 2 prisoners a month. Attorney Jim Marcus of the Texas Defender Service says it's impossible to say if this is why no other executions are scheduled following Powell until after the elections, when the state usually executes 2 to 3 prisoners a month.
It may well be that Mr. Cornyn has decided not to set a lot of dates right before his Senate election. It certainly was the case that the AG's office backed off on the setting of dates during the months preceding the presidential election in 2000.
Powell's attorney has filed for a stay from the United States Supreme Court and requested a 30-day reprieve from Governor Rick Perry. The governor's office refuses to comment until all legal developments are complete. Should Powell's request be denied, he will be executed at 6 p.m. Central Time Tuesday night. I'm Renee Feltz, reporting from Houston, Texas, for Free Speech Radio News.
After weeks of growing tensions, hundreds of janitors in the Boston area began their strike last night at 17 downtown office buildings and over a dozen suburban buildings. They are threatening to stay out until they receive better pay and health benefits. The janitors were joined by hundreds of students and members of the community at a rally at Northwestern University as they began the first day of a citywide strike. The protest was organized by the Student Labor Action Project, an activist group from several area campuses, reaching out in solidarity with labor unions. Chuck Rosina has this report from Boston.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Justice!
Yesterday's rally was the kickoff event for the janitors' citywide strike.
Justice!
The janitors' union has targeted buildings cleaned by Unicor Services Company of Newton, the area's largest cleaning contractor, demanding higher wages and health benefits for a largely immigrant Latino workforce. Most of the janitors don't have full-time jobs or benefits, and receive as little as $39 a day for their work. The strike is expected to expand to dozens more buildings in the coming days. Janitors gathered at picket sites around the city last night, and with the aid of students and community supporters, put on street theater illustrating the situation. As Latino immigrants, many janitors speak little or no English, but that did not stop them from speaking out for justice.
The struggle has begun.
Desde este momento,
as of this moment,
nos convertimos,
we are converting ourselves
en soldados,
in soldiers
para defender la libertad,
to defend our freedom,
para defender la dignidad del obrero,
to defend the worker's dignity,
para defender la justicia social,
to defend social justice.
Desde este momento,
as of this moment,
cada uno de nosotros,
each one of us,
tiene que ser más fuerte y valiente.
Has to be more strong and more courageous.
Aquellos traidores que no nos apoyen,
those traitors that do not want to support us,
la posteridad los juzgará como los Judas del nuevo milenio.
They shall be like the Judas of the new millennium.
Union members walked off the job after weeks of tense negotiations led to an impasse with cleaning contractors. The parties had appeared to be close to an agreement in mid-September, but the talks ended when the union demanded that all 1,500 janitors be provided health insurance benefits, and the cleaning contractors said they would try to provide insurance for perhaps half that many. Sue Curry is a Boston University student and a member of SLAP, the Student Labor Action Project. She helped organize the rally.
We have about 12 universities who are involved in the Boston Student Labor Action Project altogether.
So why Northeastern is a rallying point today?
Because it's important to get students together to realize that the janitors are part of their community and they deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. And, you know, the university can't work without them working. So
after rallying at Northeastern University for about an hour, the crowd then marched into the street, blocking rush hour traffic. The police actually assisted in clearing the march path free of motor vehicles to allow protesters to get to their destination downtown. The volume of the crowd helped convince a few apprehensive workers who were considering going to work to join the line instead.
No, 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 no.
It was reported that between 10 and 20 janitors crossed the line at the 100 Federal Plaza building, but at Unico's Boston office on St. James Street, where the main rally was taking place, nobody crossed the line. With the added pressure supplied by student and community activists, it is hoped that Unico will be forced to meet some of the demands of the janitors and end the strike relatively soon. MIT student Stephanie Wee Wong is a SLAP organizer.
They deserve basic respect and dignity that the contractors have not been giving them, so we're more than happy to support them. As long as they're on strike, we as a committee are going to be showing that we are on their side, and we're going to be there until they win the contract that they deserve.
Representatives of the contractors and the union, Boston Local 254 of the Service Employees International Union, are meeting today. Unico, to pressure some of the strikers back to work, has begun recruiting replacements. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina reporting from Boston.
In New York, this past weekend, hundreds of labor organizers, academics, media workers, and students from around the country attended the annual Labor Voices, Labor Tech Conference. Participants gathered to share strategies for a more democratic media in the U.S., one that would truly amplify the voices of America's working class. Eileen Sutton was at the conference and files this report.
The conference spawned 3 days of passionate debate, but many agreed that indeed labor has fallen off the media map. 50 years ago, with 1,000 national reporters, a daily newspaper might have carried several labor stories on its front page. Working class people were once in the news, but no more. Robert McChesney is a leading media critic. He talked about the market logic of commercial news.
Most major news in this country is increasingly pitched to the top half or top third or top quarter of the population. Poor people and working class people only matter when they get in the way of the people at the top. Otherwise, they're not a story. They're not of interest. And it's a dreadful logic, and it goes directly against everything good journalism should stand for.
With roughly 35,000 news outlets across the country, how can labor penetrate the mass media silence? How can labor news be present every day on channels that workers see or hear when they're driving to or at work? By contrast, Barbara Bowen, president of the Professional Staff Congress, presented a challenge. What does labor have to say? Bowen said the U.S. working class lost its vocal cords when it broke its alliance with the political left and the nation's vital social movements. Yet she acknowledged the beating labor routinely takes in the media, and with respect for the rescue effort, she also took the corporate press to task for easy images after 9/11.
Suddenly it was cool to be a worker. But what kind of worker? What kind of throwback was there in that description of the worker? The workers that I saw lionized were always male and white and doing physical labor. And I feel that there was a kind of comfort level that the mainstream press felt in talking about workers. And okay, at last we can talk about workers who don't upset us, workers who are not immigrants, workers who are not people of color, workers who are not women. We can go back to this anachronistic worker image of a worker.
Labor, Bowen insisted, missed a crucial opportunity to speak up for the workers not represented after the tragedy. On the threat of war with Iraq, she again calls out the silence.
There's almost no serious opposition from the Democratic Party, and especially in that vacuum, labor could be the signal voice. I mean, here's a place where when we say, why isn't there coverage of labor, well, what is labor doing? I mean, if every single union were standing up and saying, this is untenable, this is an assault on workers, this is an assault on workers in Iraq, this is assault on workers here, the people who are going to pay this blood price that Tony Blair talked about, they're going to be working people throughout the world.
Raj Jayadev is the coordinator of Silicon Valley Debug, a San Jose-based media and organizing collective created by young working people. He believes media becomes a liberating, transforming tool that radically shapes critical consciousness when everyday people control media and create it. He used as an example a flashy film about the degradations of capitalism.
And you could show that to working people and say, oh, well, see, now look, I'm doing something. I'm doing progressive media. Well, you might have a progressive message, but it's not exclusively the content that makes it radical. Is the process of how it's done and who's doing it.
How does labor reclaim its voice in an age of fierce media consolidation? Activists say the corporate media should not define how workers speak to each other or the public. They list independent publications, links to the ethnic press, diversity in media organizations, unionists talking to reporters, town hall meetings, protests, hearings, democratic forums, media training centers, national labor newspapers, and online resources as all part of a burgeoning solution. Most important, they say, workers of all ages need to be reached through the media they use, they create, and they trust. For Free Speech Radio News in New York, this is Eileen Sutton.
Thanks for listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Carlos Favara, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez.